Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silly Cast podcast, hosted at podfeed.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Apple bias. Today is Saturday, January 6, 2018, and this is show number 661. Well, you're getting the show early this week because Steve and I are off to CES starting on Sunday. So expect a lot of Steve's amazing videos. We're going to do interviews at a bunch of the press events. Should be a lot of fun. Really looking forward to it. But we had to get the show out early because we never miss a No Silly Cast. It's going to be a kind of a different show. I've got a couple of announcements to tell you, then a listener story from David Bogdan from Japan and one from Denise Crown. At that point, though, I'm actually going to hand you over to Bart and me in Security Bits because there was so much to talk about with so many big stories. It was hard to believe when we started Security Bits, he went chronologically, and it didn't start with Meltdown Inspector. We had to talk about how password managers are being used as trackers, even the built-in ones from web browsers. We talked about the IO Hideous vulnerability, and then we spent a lot of time learning the truth as of yesterday was Friday when we talked about it, about Meltdown Inspector. Those two vulnerabilities have been evolving just so rapidly this week, but it was a really fascinating session, and Bart unpacks all of this beautifully, of course. In chit-chat across the pond this week, we've got another installment of Programming by Stealth. And in this one, Bart teaches us about inheritance, which is relationships between classes, and he talks about polymorphism. Now, before he started, he said, I'm really worried about telling you about this because polymorphism is a concept that throws most first-level college students. But in an odd twist, I did not find it confusing at all. Poor Bart, he can never tell when I'm not going to understand. Anyway, it was really fun because he let us play with cows, ducks, and turkeys in his example, so it was tons and tons of fun. You can find this episode in either the full Chit Chat Across the Pond podcast feed or the Programming by Stealth podcast feed in your podcatcher of choice. This week, I had the great pleasure to be interviewed by Rich Straffolino on IT Origins as part of Gestalt, or is it Gestalt? IT, I'm not sure how to pronounce that. Anyway, the interview was about my career in IT, how I got into the field, and changes that I've seen over time. Now, it's possible I may have gone on a couple of rants about what really bugs me about the IT organization I was in. Not sure if it's true of all IT organizations, but there's some things that I disagreed with philosophically. And I also gave some serious philosophy thoughts that I think IT people would benefit from embracing. You can check this out at gestaltit.com. Okay, the live chat room was being super helpful. Alistair told me that Gestalt, or is it Gestalt, is pronounced just like GIF. Or is it GIF? I really am glad that the live chat room is actually here on an emergency session on a Saturday night. Well, I was also on the Daily Tech News Show on Friday, where Tom, Sarah, and I talked about the day's news, and then we discussed the top trends expected at CES and what we think about those trends. To give you a little hint of what the episode was about, the title was IoT, the Internet of Toilets. Well, I'm also super excited. I'm going to be on DTNS during CES on Tuesday in the Central Hall Broadcast Tower. I don't know what that means, but it sounds really cool. I'm hoping it's one of those big things where you're like in a booth and you got like windows. You're looking down on all the little people. It's probably a closet that's just up in an upstairs hallway or something. But that's my vision of what it's going to be like. By the way, if you are in town, if you're going to be in Vegas for CES, there's a DTNS meetup at the MGM Grand Level Up Arcade at 8 p.m. on Tuesday night. If you are in town, Steve and I would love to see you there. My new favorite outlining tool for the Mac and iOS is Cloud Outliner, and I think I've told you about it before, but I was so excited about it, I created a tutorial for Don McAllister's Screencast Online, and it's available now at screencastonline.com. Screencast Online is a paid service, but you can actually get a free 10-day trial to check out this video and the back catalog. So go check it out if you want to see everything about Cloud Outliner. And it's really good to watch the ones where I'm excited about the tool, and I am super excited about Cloud Outliner. Well, let's hand things off to Denise Crown for an interesting story.
Hi, castaways. Denise Crown again with a tip that might help some of you with pesky customer service issues. The TLDR version is I received a $324.96 credit back from Verizon. Now here's what happened. I bought myself a shiny new iPhone X after dropping into my local Verizon store to gaze upon it with my own eyes. The rep basically told me I could trade my 7 Plus and my bill would increase just a few dollars. I ordered the phone and went on my way. Fast forward a couple weeks and the phone arrives and a few days later, my bill. When they processed the order, they removed a credit of $27.08 per month as a promo on my husband's phone. With 12 months remaining on that promo, it was $325. Back to the store to discuss the missing credit and explain that they took my husband's credit instead of mine. I didn't have one anyway. And a different rep told me that's how we do it with trades. And essentially, any promo credit you have is theirs if you are on a family plan and someone changes a phone. It would have been nice to know that up front. At this point, I decide if I'm going to have to keep the iPhone 10 or return it and reclaim my credit or keep fighting to get the credit back. I called customer service and got the same story, which for Verizon in and of itself is kind of a miracle that two people tell you the same thing, and they pointed me to some fine print in the contract. I could have accepted that if my husband were trading in his phone, but I didn't have anything to do with his transaction, and now it's a matter of principle. I decided to contact the Better Business Bureau with my politely worded complaint, and the very next day I received a call from a lovely lady in executive relations who asked me if I wanted a lump sum or the monthly credit. While we were talking, she processed the credit and we were done. Sometimes big companies get it wrong, but the good ones make it right. I've been a Verizon customer a long time and I pay a premium for their service. And sometimes they really delight me, as in this case. Hope that helps some of you with your customer service problems.
Okay, there's so many things I really like about this recording from Denise. First of all, oh, come on. I cannot believe that two different Verizon reps gave the exact same story. That's just crazy talk, Denise. But the other thing is that Denise says that Verizon delighted her. And I think she's a much more optimistic and uplifted person than I am, which is why I like being friends with her. If I had to call the Better Business Bureau on somebody, I'm not sure I'd put them in the category of delightful. But she does make, I think what her point is that they actually had a right to take that money from her because it said in the small print that if you touch any of the phones, the credit, any credit somebody else has gotten will disappear. But it's pretty underhanded to do it that way. So I get her point that it was a matter of principle. Anyway, I'm really glad she got her money back. And I'm a big proponent of just pursuing it. I've like talking about my father-in-law, Ken, last week. You know, he gets a lot of stuff done because he's willing to, you know, put up a stink and talk to people and escalate and get people to pay attention to him. In any case, thank you very much for that, Denise. All right. Next up, we have the very first audio contribution by David Bogdan. He is an American. I think he's an American, but he lives in Japan. And we've been in contact for absolutely forever. But this is his first audio contribution. And he did great.
Hello, Allison, and happy new year from Japan. I kind of had a problem to be solved. And listening to your podcast this morning, I don't know the podcast number offhand, provided the solution, or at least a solution. As has happened to me on numerous occasions in the past, today I found myself wanting to view a video on my Mac, which would not play without me installing Flash Player. And this is something I definitely did not want to do. On my iPad, however, I was able to view that same video on the same website, and that got me to thinking that that means that the video can play without Flash. And lo and behold, in your podcast segment about helping your father-in-law solve his bank sign-in woes, you mentioned something called response design mode on Safari, which seems to let the browser emulate or imitate being on various devices, including iDevices. This got me to thinking again, this time, whether this mode would allow me to obviate the Flash requirement in order to view a video. I just tried it, and it worked. I entered the mode via the develop menu and chose the largest size iPad Pro as the device. In that mode, I was able to view the video fine on my iMac. Yay. When I turned off the response design mode, the video would still play. And being a tad paranoid and definitely tech challenged, I wondered if using that mode could have somehow installed Flash on the Mac. However, when I backed out of that page and re-entered it, and also tried another video on the same site, I got the same Flash Player needed message, so I guess I'm safe. While this might not be using the mode in the exact way it was intended, I can't see that there's anything untoward about doing it, as the video is being offered in a non-Flash format anyway. Just wanted to run this by you to see what you think. There's no doubt a much better and less roundabout method for doing this, but I'm just happy I did not have to install anything extra to get it done. As always, thanks much for the podcasts, and please keep them coming.
I love this. This is such a clever, clever hack that he came up with. That's really, really fun. I do have to say that David and I have not yet figured out why this site is demanding Flash. The site in particular he was looking at was a BBC site, and he was watching Russian videos. This guy's multilingual. I mean, he's crazy. He knows all these languages. I know one. Anyway, I went and watched one of the videos, and it did not demand Flash of me. And so I described it. I said, oh, I saw one that was had a puppy, and it was one of these Russian sites, one of these Russian videos. And he went to the same one, and that one definitely tells him he needs Flash. So we're still trying to figure out why his Mac seems to think it's Flash and mine does not. So not really sure what's going on here. But in the meantime, I think it's a terrific hack to figure out a way to not go and install Flash. Well, you may have noticed that this podcast does not have any ads. It does cost money to produce, but rather than advertising, we're supported by you. You can support the show in several different ways. You could do reviews like Denise and David did this week, but you could also do what a couple of other people have done. This week, Nick Riley chose to use Patreon to support the show. If you go to podfeet.com/Patreon, you can pledge a small dollar amount per show like Nick did, and you'll be charged once a month. When I say per show, by the way, I only count the NoSilicast, so, you know, it's like you get to chat across the pond for free, and everybody loves free stuff, right? Well, anyway, if recurring support is not your thing and you want to support the show with a one-time amount, you could do like Eric Fontenot did and go to podfeet.com/PayPal and push the big blue button right there and pick any number you like, you know, $1,000, whatever you like. Anyway, you can also go over to podfeet.com and push the big red button at the top that says support the show, and you'll be linked to all the different ways you can help out. Big thanks to Nick and Eric for their very generous support of the Podfeet podcast. Well, it's that time of the week again. It is time for Security Bits with Bart Bouchatz. And, you know, I was thinking we should just cancel this week. I mean, there's not much to do, right?
I was wondering how precisely you were going to make your usual joke that nothing has happened on the single busiest week of security news in some time.
Yeah, yeah. I got to say, though, like Let's Talk Apple, in that you get a chance to sit back and really analyze and think about the things that have happened over the course of the month, I am yet again really, really, really glad we did not do this the day after this all broke.
Well, even I'm a little bit nervous. So we're recording this. We definitely need to say this for today. We are recording this on Friday, the 5th of January.
3:28 p.m. news stories, California time.
3 p.m. American time at 23:28 GMT. A lot of the news stories in here broke today, January 5th. Like, I wrote these show notes yesterday and I rewrote them four times today because kept on coming out.
You wrote them when we said we were going to record at 2, and you sent them again when we said we were going to record at 3. So,
yeah, this is really hot off the presses. So even now that we've waited a few days, we're still learning more constantly. So if we'd gone straight away, there would have been an awful lot of me going,
or maybe, oh my god, this is true, and then it isn't, right?
To be honest, there's been very little of that. What there has been is fuzziness. The mist has been lifting.
Well, but it was lot more sky is falling 2 days ago than it is now.
I would argue the opposite.
Oh, okay. So, well, maybe we
less
should
sky
actually
is falling 2 days ago than it is now. Because initially it was, if you don't have an Intel CPU, you're grand. And then ARM went, nope.
Okay, well, let's
anyway, we're skipping ahead two here. We have two other security mediums that broke first.
And I cannot believe I totally forgot about these other two. When I saw them in the show notes, I was like, oh my gosh, that was this week.
Yeah, I did them in chronological order. I basically started at the bottom of my RSS reader and worked my way up.
Yikes.
So we have three security mediums, and we arguably could have had a fourth, but I decided to just pop it in as a normal news story.
And I do like the first within a given definition of medium.
Well, our definition of medium is needs talking about. So the last one I've sort of decided that we could have talked about it in detail, but I think we have sufficient.
Okay.
I think there is enough here to talk about. So the first one is a news story that broke that actual trackers on the real internet are actually using password managers of all kinds to track us as we surf the net. And when I say password manager, I do not only mean third-party plugins. I mean any feature in any browser to fill in usernames and passwords, including the built-in features in your browser.
Okay. I thought it was just the ones built into your browser, not the third-party ones, but it's the third-party ones too?
It's everything. If at some point the username and password end up magically filled in, then this JavaScript uses that to track you. So the way this works is that these tracking companies have JavaScript that they ask their customers, and their customers, remember, is not you. You are not the customer of a tracker. You are the product. Mm-hmm. So the customer are the websites who are paying for analytics data. So you're running a website and you want to know who's visiting your website. You would strike up a relationship with the tracking company who would basically give you a little embed code for some JavaScript of their writing that you embed into your web page. You know, like you would do for for legitimate things like having, say, a Google search box or whatever. You know, you have these little bits of code you copy and paste in.
Sure.
Well, in this case, it's a bit of JavaScript code from these tracking companies. And what it does is it just waits using the various JavaScript event libraries that we've learned about in programming by stealth. It waits to see if something fills in the username field. If something does fill in the username field, it hashes it and uses that as a cookie.
And that's never going to change. So it somehow knows when it's happening automatically and not when we type it by hand?
Oh, it doesn't care whether we do it, which way around we do it. So the thing is, it doesn't only do it on login pages. So if it only did it on the login page, it wouldn't be a very good tracker. So what it does is it creates a hidden login box, which the password managing feature sees because it's in the HTML code, but which you, the human being, do not see because it's behind another layer or because it's moved off the edge of the screen. It's in some way obscured so that you, the user, think you're just on a normal page. I want to be clear. Ars Technica do not do this. But hypothetically speaking, imagine that we were living in the Star Trek Mirror Universe and Ars Technica had a pointy beard.
Well, use podfee.com.
Okay, podfee.com. Allison has a pointy beard, which is a bizarre image. But let's go with it. So you would... See, it's not a great example because you probably wouldn't have an account on podfeet.com. But imagine you're a regular commenter on the blog, and so you've created an account on Allison's WordPress so that you can more easily comment and have your name and your picture show up and stuff. You would then go to Allison's page and you would log in once, and that would be normal enough, and that's not in any way surprising or unusual. But then you just browse around, and let's say you're looking at last week's Security Light. So you're now on a page where you're not actively logging in. So you, the human being, do not see a login box. However, the JavaScript from eviltracker.com that Allison has intentionally installed in her site because she's now evil, that tracker has made an invisible login box that's not visible to you, the human, but that your browser has filled in for you because your browser sees it in the HTML and your browser thinks it's doing the right thing.
Hang on.
So then the JavaScript...
This is where I asked a question and your answer did not make sense in this context. If I type the username and password in by hand, does it also... Oh, but you wouldn't type it in by hand into the automatic one.
You can't see it. Yeah.
I got you.
It's a hidden input. It's a hidden login box. So every page you go to on podfee.com has this hidden login box, which is being filled in behind your back by your password manager. And that way, a lot of websites use the email address as the password. So this is exceptionally powerful for websites that use email addresses because your email address is going to follow you all around the net. So the tracking company gets to tie your identities on different websites together because your password manager is auto-filling your username field, which is actually your email address. And therefore, if it's allison@podfeet.com on one website and also allison@podfeet.com on the other website, that is the same person. So the tracker has now very, very successfully tied you together, your two disparate identities. Which it could never have done otherwise.
It's not the password, though. It doesn't know the password, does it?
Most web browsers, you secure the password field. So you can't use JavaScript to read out passwords. Okay. It uses a secure mode for password fields. But the username field is just a plain old text box. And so, we know from programming by stealth that we can read from text boxes.
Sure.
We've done it.
George from Tulsa a long time ago talked about obfuscating your username by making it not an email address.
You'd have to have a different one on every website, but then you're going to be confusing yourself immensely. Yes, if you have a different username on every website, then this technique cannot connect the different U's together.
Okay.
Because you're different everywhere. The reason this works so well is because human beings will generally either be very consistent in their choice of username, or they will use an email address as the username, in which case the consistency is kind of there by default.
And a lot of times the website demands it be an email address.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Okay.
And yeah, so it is a very clever approach, but at the end of the day, the browser manufacturers can fix this.
Oh, they can. Okay.
Yeah. They just need to update. So the browser manufacturers and or the makers of the third-party plugins, they both need to update their code so that it will only fill in the username and password fields if those fields are visible. And we can use JavaScript to tell if something is visible.
Yeah. We know
so it's just an
that.
If statement, basically. They just need to, they need to write a carefully worded if statement, but ultimately this is fixable. And so it's just a case that the browser vendors are going to have to react to this new reality and make their code a little bit more untrusting.
Yeah.
A little bit more reticent to fill in the stuff.
In the sky is falling category, this is tracking, not loss of personal data from a password manager. Or web browser.
Precisely.
Okay.
Yeah. So this is basically you think you've installed various plugins to protect your privacy, but here's yet another way that you are being tracked.
Okay.
And that's all it is. It's okay. I don't like being tracked.
Sure.
But it's different to having all of my money stolen. So while this doesn't make me happy, this also does not involve any sort of hair on fire.
Right. Right. Okay. Good.
So that's the first medium. So that's basically password managers being used as trackers. And you kind of have to admire the evil genius. It is evil, but it is genius. So security medium, the second, was the one I thought would be our big story to talk about in great detail, which is something it's a vulnerability in macOS, which has been around since at least 2002. It's called IO Hideous. The reason is because it's in a part of the OS kernel called IOHID family, and HID stands for Human Interface Device. In other words, it's in a driver for IO. It's an IO driver for human interface devices.
Like a mouse would be a human interface device.
So a mouse, a keyboard, those are human interface devices. So what this bug allows is something that's called privilege escalation. So in theory, in a Unix-like operating system, like macOS, every process runs as a certain user, and the OS enforces permissions. So the user, Allison, does not have the right to alter the kernel and things like that, because that's running as the user root, which has different privileges to you.
Mm-hmm.
A privilege escalation bug bypasses those controls. So what it means is that a process running as a non-root user can gain root privileges without a password being needed. So normally you would need a password. You would need to do sudo space the name of the command you want to run as root, or you would need to click on the little lock icon in the control panel and then, you know, you use a password to elevate your privileges. This kind of vulnerability gives you root privileges through the back door. It should not be possible, hence it is a bug.
Okay.
And so this is a privilege escalation bug, which is not a good thing, right? It is not a good thing that any app on your Mac can do anything, is what this means. It means that your OS's security controls are massively hobbled. However, it is only something running on your Mac that can do this. So these kind of vulnerabilities are not good and need to be patched, but their main use is as a lever that only really attacks you when used in concert with something else. So for a bad guy to make use of this, the bad guy needs to get some code running on your computer. And so there's two ways they can do that. The good old-fashioned let's just trick you. In other words, social engineering, the squishy organic bit, whatever way you want to describe that. So a Trojan would be a classic form of tricking a user. They somehow get you to download an app and run it. And that app would then be able to get admin rights without ever asking for your password, which is really not good. The other approach is to find another bug. So hypothetically speaking, there's some sort of vulnerability in, say, the JPEG library. So they send you an email with a JPEG, your browser or your mail client reads that JPEG, trips the bug, and now the malicious code executed by the first bug uses the second bug to become root. And so what would normally only allow the attacker to run code as the user who opened the email, suddenly they can use the second, this bug, to turn that into, I can now do admin stuff. So you chain the bugs together. One bug lets you run code as the user. The privilege escalation bug lets you run code as root. You put the two bugs together, you now have the ability to run code as root by simply sending an email. But again, there has to be a second vulnerability, and there are no known such second vulnerabilities in the fully patched version of macOS at the moment.
There's no known vulnerabilities in a patched version.
Yes. Yes, so if you're fully patched on the Mac, there isn't at the moment, there are no outstanding remote code execution bugs that Apple haven't patched that we know about.
Okay.
So if you're fully patched, then you're fully patched. I mean, there may be a bug we don't know about, which is why at any moment in time, you know, there could be a news alert that happened 10 seconds ago that says actually a bug has just been found in macOS's processing of, I'd say JPEG files are a great example. We've had that happen in the past. And a vulnerability in the JPEG library is really, really serious, because how hard is it to make you look at a picture? I can tweet it at you. I can email it to you. I can send it to you on Messenger. I can send it to you in an email.
Facebook,
I mean,
Twitter.
If there's a bug in the JPEG library, that is always bad. But right. Usually that kind of bug would run as your mail app process, which is running as you, which means it doesn't have root access. But if there is a privilege escalation bug, then that access can be escalated to full root privilege. So for the moment, if any vulnerability is found in the Mac, that vulnerability is more dangerous because this privilege escalation vulnerability exists. And so it's important that Apple quickly close that down before someone finds a way to do something else to get their foot in the door, because once their foot's in the door, they now have full root access thanks to this privilege escalation bug. You see what I mean?
Yeah, so the building block is sitting there waiting right now, and as of January 5th, they have not patched this yet. Is that correct?
That is, let me just make sure of that. Apple is aware of the vulnerability and are working on a fix. Yeah, okay, so yeah, the latest we have heard from Apple on this is that, yes, we know we're working on it, expect an update soon.
Okay.
They didn't give us a date, just we're on it. So this is Apple. It could be tomorrow, it could be 2 weeks from now. But right now there is no patch, so it's still a 0 day. But there's no need to set your hair on fire, because it's not enough on its own to get you hacked. It needs to be combined with something else. So I would say, well, no, our standard advice applies, right? Don't run software from random websites. You know, don't run stuff that you get sent in an email. Basically, just if you run some code, it could do anything, because right now any code can become root.
Okay.
So don't run random stuff on your Mac.
Okay.
Which is kind of my advice anyway, because it's always a bad idea to run random stuff on your Mac. So.
Yeah, but there are some of us who run a lot of stuff.
Sure. Yeah. Be a little bit extra vigilant until this is patched. How's that?
Okay. Sounds good.
So that then brings us to the biggie. This is definitely going to go down in history as a major event in the history of IT security, because there is a pair of related bugs which affect just about everything with a CPU in it. Not quite everything, but pretty darn close to everything with a CPU in it. And the thing is, this isn't a quick fix. You will notice there's a word being used in people's release notes that is mitigate. Apple don't say that they have patched. They say they have implemented mitigations.
Okay.
And everyone else is doing the same. Because actually what we have here is a fundamental design flaw. And while we can close the door on the currently known abuses of that design flaw, the design flaw still exists and new uses may come to light. So there isn't, so it's impossible patch this. All we can do is defend ourselves against all the known abuses.
Okay. You're going to tell us what this is, right?
I am, but I just want to make that point clear. This is the reason this is a red letter day is because the entire CPU industry is going to have to fundamentally redesign from this moment forward. Every new CPU being designed by every CPU manufacturer on planet Earth is going to have to ask themselves, how do we change what we were going to do yesterday so that it's no longer vulnerable to this flaw?
So there's going to be a slowdown in new chip development for a smidge here, I'm predicting.
Yeah, they're going to have to hit the pause button.
Noodle a little bit and say, what am I going to do about this?
Yeah, and to give you some sort of idea how much of a noodle this is, operating system manufacturers have been forced to redesign the core of their operating systems to stop doing something they have been doing for 20 years. That is how fundamental a shift this is. So I say, all I want to highlight right now, the second, is this is a big deal. And this is not solved. This is mitigated. And this is going to be occupying the minds of really smart people for the next few years. Not weeks or months. Years. This is a big deal. Now, I tried to write.
If you
want to
get job security, go to work in this field.
So I tried to write my own summary, and then I realized that I'm actually can't do this nearly as well as the. There is an official website for these bugs, by the way, because that's a thing now, right? You have an official website for your bugs. So I am really impressed with the official website for these bugs because they have written in the most beautiful plain English. It is short, it is accurate, and it uses simple words. It's just really good copy editing. I'm really impressed. So I've actually decided I'm going to start telling you the real details by quoting directly from the security researchers who discovered these flaws.
And by the way, that was the Google project, right? Project Zero
they
or
were
something?
One of the people. There are at least three different groups involved in these discoveries.
Meltdown, I thought, was specifically them, and they were involved in Spectre along with other people. Did I get that wrong?
Well, there was independent discovery because this whole thing was supposed to be under NDA until next Wednesday, but then it was independently discovered by other people. I don't think it's fair to say it's only Google.
Okay. Well, still, chops to them.
Yes, definitely. Okay. Project Zero are big players here, and Project Zero has done a lot of really good security work. So yes, I will certainly agree to that. So I'm going to quote now. So this is not my words, because this is way better written than I was able to do. Meltdown and Spectre exploit critical vulnerabilities in modern processors. These hardware bugs allow programs to steal data which is currently processed on the computer. While programs are typically not permitted to read data from other programs, a malicious program can exploit Meltdown and Spectre to get hold of secrets stored in the memory of other running programs. This might include your password stored in a password manager or browser, your personal photos, emails, instant messages, and even business-critical documents. Meltdown and Spectre work on personal computers, mobile devices, and in the cloud. Depending on the cloud provider's infrastructure, it might be possible to steal data from other customers. So that's okay. So now we're back to my voice, right? So that's a summary from the people who wrote this.
They forgot to say IoT.
Actually, maybe not.
Okay.
Right? Because what they don't say here is that all of this, all of these flaws have something in common, which is that they all involve optimizations that have been added to modern CPUs.
Okay.
And one of those optimizations, your CPU is second guessing you. It's called speculative execution. So there's lots of different forms of speculative execution, but the easiest one to imagine is that your code comes to an if statement and it takes work to calculate the answer to the question in the if statement. If some big condition, do this, otherwise do that. Working out the answer to the condition takes time and energy. So what speculative execution means is that based on various heuristics and rules, the CPU will just go ahead and assume the answer is true or false, whatever. It just guesses, and it does the work, but it doesn't commit it.
Okay, and then so when it finally gets the answer to the,
then it either commits what it has already done and it has now effectively stolen free time, right? It would have been just waiting on the answer, but instead it's gotten ahead and done something. So that's free performance. Or it just throws it all away and says, "Ah, well, I guessed wrong. I'll just have to do it as if I did no guessing." So
now,
it hasn't lost.
Now that's
anything.
Efficient because it had nothing else to do. Well, it would have just been sitting there waiting in if it didn't do that.
Exactly. So basically, they're using spare capacity to just take a guess. If they're right, they have been efficient. They have basically magicked performance out of nowhere. And if they're wrong, no foul.
They haven't lost anything.
They haven't lost anything because they're really waiting anyway.
Interesting.
So that's why it's an efficiency. It's kind of clever.
Yeah.
So in theory, when you discard the change, all traces of that change are gone. So if you take the wrong speculative path and you discard it, in theory, it's as if it never happened.
Right.
But as well as speculative execution, there are also a whole bunch of caches. And while the real registers never get affected by a speculative execution, caches do. And so you have a side channel. And ultimately, it's the combination of speculative execution and caching is where things go terribly, horribly wrong.
Okay.
So while the speculative execution has no effect on the real registers in the CPU, the real values in real memory, they do have detectable side effects on caches, and you can abuse the side effect. So it's a side channel attack. It's side effects that are the problem here. You can use those side effects to basically steal different bits of memory you're not supposed to have access to.
Is this sort of like how we can't see black holes, but we know they're there because something bent past them? The light bent past them?
Yes. That is a really good analogy. You're never officially given access into memory you shouldn't, but you can use other information that you would imagine would be harmless to infer what is in the memory that you are being explicitly denied access to. So you get the information through a side channel.
Okay.
So like the black hole pulls out another star, you have seen it even though you haven't seen it.
Yeah. Okay.
And the actual lowdown technical details is like quadruple propeller beanie stuff. But the point being, this is about optimizations that were added to our CPUs to make them go faster. And those optimizations have accidentally ended up ruining our security. Now, the thing is, the better your CPU, the more optimizations it has.
Oh, yeah, because if it was a slow CPU, didn't have a lot of cycles, didn't have multi-cores, it has to just work on the one job at hand. It's not; it doesn't have time to be speculating.
Yeah, so yeah? It's not so much about CPU speed as it is about CPU complexity. So the reason IoT isn't such a big deal is because they're generally using cheapo, simple, basic CPUs.
Oh,
so the reason that Apple have fixes out for all of their devices except the watch is that the CPU in the watch is so simplistic, it doesn't do any of this cool stuff.
Oh, okay. Okay, that makes
sense.
Your
IoT is the least at risk because it probably contains the cheapest possible, most basic possible CPU.
There, we found a silver lining.
We did. Yes, exactly. So basically, the more money you spent, the more at risk you are. Wait, that's a very odd silver lining, Alice. But that is the key point here. So it's modern CPUs. It's high-end CPUs. Now, the thing is, with the exception of some really crappy Atom processors and some Itaniums, everything Intel have made since like 1995 has had these optimizations in it. So the silver lining is not very silver.
The word modern is 20 years older.
Yeah. Right. So in reality, when it comes to your desktops and your laptops, just assume they're vulnerable. Older ARM chips and cheaper ARM chips are not vulnerable, but the more fancy pants ARM chips in the higher end phones are vulnerable because they are doing these kind of advanced features.
Aren't the Apple chips a derivative of ARM?
Yes, they are, which is why Apple had to update iOS.
Okay.
So anyway, so I just wanted to sort of say that this is about optimizations biting us on the backside. Now, our operating systems also contain optimizations. So the optimizations aren't only in the hardware, there are also optimizations in the design of our operating system. And it's one of those optimizations that, when combined with the problems in the chip, become the vulnerability. which is why there are so many OS updates, because you need both. You need the optimizations in the CPU negatively interacting with the optimizations in the operating system, and the two together leak information. And if either side is changed, the leak is plugged.
So are we still talking about Meltdown?
At the moment, I'm just talking very, very hand-wavingly in general, but yeah, we're about to focus in on specifically on Meltdown here.
I thought this whole time.
So up until now, I have not been focused on either bug. They all involve these optimizations.
They all involve
leaking information. So I'm being generic at the moment. I'm going to split them apart now very shortly. But the thing I want to draw a line under is that there has been in our operating systems for the last 20 years something called a page table, which is a mapping of what real memory is in what, or what virtual memory is where in physical memory or on disk. So in reality, you may only have 4 gigs of RAM, but your operating system pretends you have 16, and it maps some of it to your hard drive and some of it to real memory, and it moves stuff in and out of memory as it needs it. So it needs to keep a mapping between what's real and what's not. And in the past, there was one mapping. The operating system kept one master mapping and shared that mapping with everyone, all processes. And that is a problem when combined with the optimizations on the chips. So we've had to redesign our operating systems to have two mappings, one for the kernel and one for everyone else. So that's why you'll hear things like dual page maps is the thing you'll hear all the time. So our kernels have gone from having a single page map to having a dual page map.
Okay.
And that's where people are talking about performance hits. Because what was one cache that was able to be shared by everyone has just become two caches. That's less efficient. And that's why people are talking about, oh my God, performance hits. But we'll get back to that in a minute.
Okay.
So the reason we have all of these updates to Linux and to Windows and to Mac and to iOS is because they have had to redesign the foundations of their operating system to go from one page table to two page tables. Like, that is open heart surgery on our operating systems. And that has been done in secret over the past few months under non-disclosure agreements.
Yeah, that was an interesting piece of this, was that it was disclosed to the manufacturers, but they were given time, months and months. It was the summer or last summer or something?
I don't have the exact dates to hand, but yes, we are talking multiple months. And it was basically, they were all under NDA. And it was none of it was supposed to come out until next Wednesday. And, you know, it lasted as a secret for many, many, many months. So that is kind of impressive. But AMD deserve a scolding, because one of their engineers was extremely irresponsible with some of the stuff they released into the Linux kernel. And they put a comment on a commit to the Linux kernel that basically gave the game away without technically breaking the letter of the NDA. That engineer, it's hard to tell if it's passive-aggressive or stupid.
Hmm.
But either way, anyway, that's neither here nor there. That made me cranky about this. But on the whole,
I did wonder how it got out, and was it really responsible of, I think, was it the register that broke it?
Well, there's a bunch of stuff happened. So people were suspicious because there was this strange confluence of updates to the Linux kernel and updates coming out to the Mac and updates coming out to Windows and stuff. There was activity.
Okay.
It was like, you know, people are busy. People are stressed. People aren't saying what they're busy on, but there's all this activity. There's all of these changes. And so everyone suspected there was something afoot in the wind, as the old cliche goes. And the comment to the Linux kernel commit from AMD gave enough of a hint that someone figured it out.
Okay.
And independently discovered the vulnerabilities. And that basically forced the timetable to shift.
Well, which is why these things are now a little bit early, right? No,
say that again. Sorry,
the register reporting on it caused them to have to move out more quickly, wasn't it?
Well, no, because the register were only reporting on stuff that was already known within the security community. So, if the register hadn't reported on it, someone else would have.
Because somebody in the security community figured it out and then told all their little friends.
Right, they independently rediscovered the bug.
Okay.
So they weren't bound by any of the NDAs or stuff, because they didn't find the secret. They found the bug.
Okay.
If you see, there is an important distinction.
Yeah. Gotcha.
So the reason it's been so hard to report on this story is that because everyone was getting their press releases ready for next Wednesday, and all of a sudden it was out. And that's why it's taken a few days for this story to settle down. Because everyone's had to rush their PR. But thankfully, I think, touching wood, I think now by while we're recording on Friday evening, I get the impression things have settled down because we have really good statements from people like Google and Intel and Apple, who are big players in all of this, and Microsoft. And like the Apple one in particular, I'm really impressed with. Well, it's really human. But anyway,
AMD come out and say, oh, not us, it's just Intel?
This is the problem, right? Of all of the companies involved in this, I have nothing but good things to say about all of them except AMD. The way I heard it summarized by one security researcher in an article was, that Intel released really good white papers and some really stupid PR stuff. AMD only released technical details and said nothing PR-wise. And AMD only gave out really poor PR and gave no technical details.
Okay.
So basically, AMD is getting... The security researcher community are deeply unhappy with AMD's response to this. They have not been forthcoming. They have not been open. And they were almost gleeful about it too, right?
I mean, they were like, they were kind of, not us.
Yeah. Which is actually what they committed to the Linux kernel. They submitted a patch to detect an AMD processor and exempt it from the changes. And in the comment on that exemption, they basically put in way too much technical information and effectively let the secret out of the bag while being snotty.
That was the AMD one that left that the comment.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, I also heard that when they said not us, it's only Intel, and AMD's shares went way up.
See, that shouldn't happen because the thing is, okay, so at this stage I need to, so at the moment I've been being very generic because these two bugs are extremely similar.
Okay. Is it just a coincidence that we found out about both in the same week, or are they related?
I don't know. Okay. Often with these kind of things, when you pull on one thread, many things unravel. So it's possibly the case that security researchers thought there was something fishy about this particular CPU feature, and they were all just poking and prodding at it in different ways, and you know, two ways were found to break it. It's like security bugs tend to come in groups. Do you remember there was a time when it was all about PDFs? Because everyone was poking and prodding at the PDF and lots of problems fell out. Well, it seems like everyone was poking at the CPU features and two problems fell out. It's as best as I can make it out. So there are two bugs. The first one has been codenamed Meltdown, and the second one has been codenamed Spectre. And so I'm again going to quote the official website for these bugs. So we're now going to talk about Meltdown until I say otherwise, and then we're going to talk about Spectre.
Okay.
So to quote again, not my voice, much better written than I would have wrote it. Meltdown breaks the most fundamental isolation between user applications and the operating system. This attack allows a program to access the memory and thus also the secrets of other programs and the operating system. So that's what Meltdown does. So to put that into context, in theory, every app is isolated from every other app. And so if your browser has your password in RAM because it's logging you in, your calculator cannot read it. Which is good. That is very important. If your computer is hosting multiple virtual machines, code running in one virtual machine cannot read the memory of another virtual machine.
So there's one thing that I'm learning from this that I don't think I realized was that the CPU had anything to do with this. I always thought that was an operating system's job, was to protect the things from each other.
It is the operating system's job, but the CPU is involved in everything that's going on. So remember, these vulnerabilities come about from an interaction between OS features and CPU features, which is why we're patching it on the OS side.
Okay.
It is an interaction, right? If either you need to have both of these things it's a bit unintended side effects.
Okay. All right.
So you're right. It is the operating system's job to do this, but the operating system is running on the CPU. So the CPU does affect the operating system. The operating system does affect the CPU. Okay. And in fact, on modern CPUs, there's a very tight integration between the CPU and the operating system because the CPU is aware of concepts like ring zero and ring one processes.
Mm-hmm.
So the relationship has gotten ever tighter as these things have gotten ever more complex. I mean, as an undergrad, I wrote x86 assembly language, but modern assembly language is so much more complicated. Because CPUs are aware of virtualization and stuff. Like, it's way more complicated than it used to be and way more of an interaction than there used to be.
Okay.
So the point is, this vulnerability breaks the most fundamental security features in our operating systems, and that's why this is such a big deal. Now, Meltdown is kind of the two bugs, it's the nicest because on the one hand, it is by far the easiest to exploit. And it is by far the easiest to exploit on an Intel chip. So no one is prepared to nail their colors to the mast on this. It may be possible to do this on an AMD chip. AMD say it isn't. Security researchers say it probably isn't. But none of them are saying it isn't. They're all hedging.
Okay.
AMD have said it is theoretically possible. Therefore, we are proactively providing patches to the Linux kernel, which they did. So no one's actually managed to do it on an AMD, but AMD have said, look, we think this is theoretically possible, and here's the software fix to be put into the Linux kernel. So that's, in other words, here is an open source fix for this problem on our CPUs.
Okay.
So that's why the ARM stuff, that's why Apple are updating iOS, because iOS devices are ARM devices. The ARM engineers provided code. Apple were then able to use that to incorporate it into iOS.
Okay, good.
So ARM have been very proactive about this. But Intel have like massive flashing lights. This is easy to do on an Intel CPU.
Okay.
It might be possible on ARM, but we don't know how. And AMD, it might be possible on AMD, and ARM say it's probably possible, so here's a fix. Okay. And the great news is this is easy to fix. All you have to do to fix this...
Wait, you haven't said what it is yet.
I'm not going down into the technical details, right? The bug allows memory to be stolen from processes it shouldn't, and the fix is to change the kernel from one page table to two page tables.
Okay.
So that's
by the way,
fix.
It is really interesting to read that in the first link Bart gave the technical explanation. It's pretty cool stuff. It is interesting. But okay.
Yes, it is. And if you want to put your propeller beanie on, actually, if you want to listen to security now, any of these podcasts are going to give you great detail on what's going on. It's very clever,
mm-hmm.
right? Like there's some really good computer science going on here, right? Like this is good stuff.
Anybody
but I
we're smart
don't
enough?
Feel comfortable going down to that level because okay. I'm not enough of an expert in the inner workings of a CPU to have an informed conversation. I understand the implications. I understand enough to follow all the cool technical stuff, but that's not the same as teaching it.
Okay.
So I don't want to teach it because others are doing it better than I can.
Great.
So mitigating this is easy. You just change your operating system from having one page table to two page tables and the problem is solved. I say just, it's a complete redesign of the basic core of your kernel. But that's what's been happening. So Windows have done it for Windows 10 and Windows 10 only. Apple have done it for macOS, iOS, and tvOS. They have not done it for watchOS for the simple reason that the CPU inside Apple Watches is too primitive.
No.
So this just doesn't apply.
On macOS and on Windows, I had a question. They said specifically that the fix was already in 10.13.2. What about Sierra and El Capitan?
No fix. And I doubt they would because you're talking about doing open heart surgery on an OS that's not current anymore.
No, but they're supported OSs.
They are.
How do you say it's a supported OS?
Don't think you're going to see a fix for this. I think basically it's time to update if you care about this stuff.
Huh. So I was looking at it and... I'm not saying you're wrong. I was just trying to find the answer on my own before asking you. On Apple, Apple has about the security content of macOS High Sierra 10.13.2 security update, blah, blah, blah for Sierra and blah, blah, blah for El Capitan. They're all on one page. But they don't say the word meltdown, so I don't know how to tell whether it's in there or not.
See, you can't, because those release notes were released before the embargo was lifted. So those release notes explicitly don't tell you.
Yeah. But you explicitly know that they have not patched Sierra and El Capitan? Or
okay, what I explicitly know, so Apple's full statement is linked in the show notes. So I'm only going by what they have said they have done, and they have only said, they have said explicitly that the update is, this okay. vulnerability is fixed in 10.13.2.
Okay. Okay, so...
So they have explicitly said that that's the version with the fix.
Okay. Good to know.
And they haven't said anything else.
Has Microsoft also only said...
silence means...
Has Microsoft also only said about 10? Windows 10?
Yes. Yes.
Wow.
But remember, this is open heart surgery on the operating system. Yeah. I would be very surprised if you were to backport something like that to Windows 8.
But you have to then say this is no longer a supported operating system. You have to change your language. You have to say, nope.
Well, see, Microsoft like backwards compatibility, so I wouldn't be surprised if a month from now there is a fix backported to Windows 8. That wouldn't shock me. I would be... Actually, I'd be 50-50 on whether Apple will or won't backport it, but right now they haven't backported it. So all I can... Like, they haven't told us they won't, but they also haven't told us they will, so your guess is kind of as good as mine.
Okay, all right.
My feeling is I don't think so, but that's just... I'm just pulling that out of somewhere.
Okay. Okay. Good to know. I have been very curious. And that was my top question to ask you today. So
okay. Well, I'm going to actually go through each vendor in detail in a few minutes.
Okay.
Because they are worth, there's a few caveats, there's a few niggles here and there, little bits of small print that I think we should
draw
attention
to. This one's a real onion.
Oh, it really is. Oh, it really is. Do you have any, like, no, you know exactly how much trouble these show notes were because you saw how many revisions there have been.
Here it is. I'm done. Nope. Now I'm done. Nope. Now I'm done. Oh,
yeah. It's seriously, I'm glad I had a few days to digest this.
Yeah.
So anyway, Meltdown. Bottom line, easy to exploit on Intel, easy to fix. I can live with that. Then we go on to Spectre. So again, I'm going to start by reading the summary from the bug's official webpage. Spectre breaks the isolation between different applications. It allows an attacker to trick error-free programs which follow best practices into leaking their secrets. And now, this is me talking for a second. The next sentence is the kick in the goolies. In fact, the safety checks of said best practices actually increase the attack surface and may make applications more susceptible to Spectre.
Jeez.
And then they end with a slight happy note. Spectre is harder to exploit than Meltdown, but it is also harder to mitigate. Back to my voice now.
Okay.
So the good news is that, generally speaking, it is really hard to successfully exploit Spectre, with a caveat we'll get to in a moment. But it's also really hard to provide a general catch-all solution. So what we're dealing with is knocking down each special case as it's discovered. And there is one special case at the moment that has been discovered and is in the process of being twatted on the head. And that special case is a technique has been found to use, of all things, JavaScript to exploit Spectre, which is why every web browser has been updated or is about to be updated.
Hmm.
So of all things, our good friend JavaScript is the current vector for Spectre. But fixing the browser does not fix Spectre. It fixes this particular avenue of attack. There will be more avenues of attack because nothing that has been found yet fixes Spectre at a fundamental level. This is going to be haunting us for a long time. And in the FAQ, they ask, why did you call it Spectre? And they actually say, because this is going to haunt the IT industry for years.
Hmm.
So they actually call it Spectre to underline the point that this is ongoing whack-a-mole.
So let me break this down or summarize what I think I've heard is Meltdown is between the user applications and the operating system, and Spectre is application to application.
Yeah, and no one has figured out a general way to protect. No one has figured out a shield that just works in the general case. All we've been able to do is stop explicit attacks.
So do we know why this, so this is at the chip level. This is a problem, right? Is this,
yes.
And this is all CPUs?
Yes. Yeah. So this one, there's no getting away from this. Every CPU from Intel, from AMD, and from ARM is affected by this. Basically, this is everything.
Okay.
So this one, it is also, though, more difficult to exploit. So it's both difficult to exploit and difficult to protect from.
Well, wait a minute. You just write yourself some little JavaScript and you can exploit it.
Right.
You said.
Okay. So leaving aside the one known attack, which we do know how to protect against, leaving that aside, the general case is that exploitation is difficult and there is no known attacks apart from this one easily fixable JavaScript thing. So there's no other known attacks, but there's also no known universal defense. So all we're going to be doing is playing whack-a-mole. Someone's going to find a new vector. We're going to fix the vector. Someone's going to find another new vector. We're going to fix that new vector. But there's no one has even dreamt up of a way of just protecting against everything. Mm-hmm. And until someone does figure that out, it's going to be whack-a-mole.
Forever.
Not forever, right? Because at the end of the day, 5 years from now, we're going to be designing CPUs which either do not have a whole bunch of these optimizations. So basically, we may end up going back to simpler CPUs. We may decide less optimization, more grunt. We may just throw raw power at things and stop being so clever.
So one of the reasons I said at the beginning was, it might have been before we got on the air, was that it sounded worse 2 days ago than it did today, because one of the things they said was going to be a problem was every CPU was going to be slower. Linux calculations can be 5 to 30% slower. And now they're saying, no, it's really not that bad.
Okay. So yeah, I also want to touch on that, on that slowness thing, because that's important too. Well, there was a lot of FUD about that, and that FUD has evaporated, or whatever FUD does to become not so FUDdy.
Well, it does seem kind of to make sense that if you can't do this speculative computing that you were doing, that things would be slower because you did it to be faster.
See, the thing is, you're not stopping the speculative branching.
Oh, you aren't?
Right. No.
Oh.
Right. So the problem is the combination of speculation and a single page table.
Oh, okay. Back to that single page table.
Right. So you have to have both. So once you split the page table, you no longer have both. Therefore, the exploit doesn't work.
Well, maybe they figured that page table
out. However, you now have two page tables.
Okay, but maybe they figured that page table out thing this week.
No. Basically, the fear was that splitting that page table, which has been united for the last 20 years, would be a massive hit in performance.
Okay.
And it's turned out that in reality, splitting that page table is much less of a problem than was feared.
Okay. Gotcha.
Well, I say I have some actual numbers on that a bit later in the show notes.
All right.
So this is sort of where we stand. So I'm just going to do a summary based on all the different vendors and what we know. So first off, Apple. Apple have already patched macOS, iOS, and tvOS, and they say they don't need to patch watchOS. There are further updates on the way from Apple. Specifically, Apple have said there are Safari updates coming. And right now, it's only macOS High Sierra and iOS 11 that have been patched.
So, and they had done this before the story broke.
Yes.
Because 10.13.2 was already out. I mean, that doesn't mean they were great ahead of the game. They knew that everybody was working on it. They just happened to be a couple of days early or a week early or something.
Yeah, and in the Linux kernel, you can kind of see the evolution more in real time, because, of course, the Linux kernel is open source. So you can see, you know, tweaks and changes happening over weeks and months.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in Apple's case, they just dropped an update, right? So, but they were working on it and they dropped the update, and that's that.
Okay.
So that's Apple. The Linux kernel has been updated, and so all of the different Linux distributions have these updates available. So before we went on air, you patched Podfeet. I've been patching many, many servers.
Actually, you need to mock me first, remember? So when Bart and I first got on, he was talking about restarting one of his servers, and I said, oh, wait, do I have to do my servers, Bart? And he just started laughing. It was adorable of me to not even think of the fact that I had to do something about it. So Podfeet.com and Podfeet.com, the chat server, have both been patched.
Yes. So that's Linux taken care of. Google have also patched Android, Android was patched today, and Chrome OS was actually patched a few weeks ago, because Chrome OS runs the Linux kernel, and so basically they piggybacked on the work done on Linux. And Android, in fact, runs a modified Linux kernel, so I'm guessing Android also did a lot of piggybacking there. But again, that update was released today, 5th of January. So that is, the Android patch level for protection is 2018-01-05. That's the patch level you need to be protected. So obviously that's going to take time.
Is that, do we know anything on, maybe you said it and I missed it, saying it's released updates for Android, does that mean just whatever we're on, the hopscotch or Oreo or something?
So Google have introduced this concept of a patch level where you, mm-hmm. where basically your OS tells you what its patch level is. And the magic word, the patch level that you need is 2018-01-05.
Okay.
So whatever flavor of Android you're on, if your patch level has that number, you're good.
Okay.
And if your patch level is lower, you're bad.
Okay.
And given how complex the Android ecosystem is, that's kind of as much as I'm prepared to say.
Sure.
Because that's what they said. I'm quoting their statement. So I don't want to improvise around Android stuff because it makes my head hurt. It's not a simple OS.
Yeah. Okay.
So the Chrome OS is patched, version 63 and above. The Chrome browser is not patched, but Google are working on it. And at the moment, they have given an estimated delivery date of January 23. So two weeks away-ish.
Okay.
Microsoft have updated Windows 10 and implemented this dual page tables contraption. But there are caveats. First off, because a whole bunch of antivirus products do things that are not supported by any official Microsoft API. They basically poke and prod around bits of the OS that they're not supposed to. And this has been a thorn in Microsoft's side for a very long time.
What pokes and prods around?
Antivirus, AV.
Oh, right. Okay.
So as soon as Microsoft started testing their fix, a whole bunch of AV products started BSODing left, right, and center.
BSODing?
Blue screen of death.
Ah. Okay.
Because remember, when the kernel falls over in a heap, you get on a Mac, you get that full hard crash where it says, please restart your Mac now. And on Windows, you get the blue screen of death. That means that I can do nothing. The core of the OS has fallen over in a heap.
Okay.
There's no recovering from that. Right. So that's a BSOD in Windows land.
I've just never heard it pronounced.
So because of that fact, the Microsoft updater will check to see if you have AV installed. If you have AV installed, it will then check for a special registry key it has told all of the antivirus vendors about. Well, in fact, it's publicly released. And if that registry key has been set, that is a signal to Microsoft that the version of antivirus is okay with the new system. And then the update will be installed. So basically, it's up to McAfee and all of those people to update their code and then have their updater set this flag in the registry. That's basically a signal to Windows update that I'm ready. Have at it. I'm good to go. So if you have antivirus and that antivirus hasn't yet been updated, you're not going to get this update until your antivirus is updated. And then your antivirus will raise a little white flag to say, I'm ready, go for it. And then Windows update will offer you this update to Windows 10.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. But
And it's a good idea, right? I like the engineering Microsoft came up with here. It's a very straightforward, you tell us when you're ready and then we'll go ahead.
And the user knows what they need to do in order to get there.
Exactly. And the AV companies can test this very easily, right? They run their product and see if they get a blue screen of death. You know, so it's easy to fix. And then they just highlight the fact that they have fixed it by setting this flag. So it's a very good solution. Now, Windows Server is another kettle of fish. So Windows Server is obviously, the idea is that only professionals would run Windows Server. So in Windows Server, because of concerns about performance, Microsoft made the decision that they would not enable the dual page table by default. They would leave it to every administrator of a Windows Server to choose when to enable the dual page table on their servers. So this is only the server version I'm talking about now, but it will never turn the dual page table on by itself. You have to do it.
Is that a good way to do it, do you think?
I can see why they did it that way, because at the end of the day, you're dealing with IT professionals, and IT professionals, as a rule, prefer to be in control. So right. You could push this out through
and you could make
all of
choice.
The management tools, right? So Microsoft provide you with tools to manage your Windows infrastructure.
Right. And well, and you could choose that if you've got if this server is running the ventilators for the people with lung issues, that you'll take a chance, right? And maybe not do it today. Till you have a backup server ready.
It's not so, right. Take a chance is an interesting phrasing because I would actually say you could make an informed decision because remember the vulnerability here is that it allows processes within the same operating system that shouldn't be able to look into each other's memory to look into each other's memory. So if your server is running an app for person A and an app for person B, problem, because the isolation between person A and person B is gone. But if your server is only doing things that you trust, if all of the code running on your server is for you, then so what if your code can see your code? Right? The isolation isn't important to you in that context. So it's okay to keep running with the old-fashioned page table. So it is about making an informed decision.
Yeah. Okay. But making a trade-off.
The short answer is yes, Allison. I think they did this right.
Okay, good, good.
So that takes care of the operating system. So what about the browsers? Edge and IE are already patched. Firefox was patched today, so it is now patched. And Google are working on their patch, and it will be out on January 23. Okay, so now we come to the question of, here everything's going to be terribly slow, Allison. So you mentioned the 30% number. That number has a backstory, right? That number wasn't pulled out of someone's backside. That number has a history. But unfortunately, the number and its context have gotten separated and it's being horribly misinterpreted. So, in order to find the absolute worst possible case, someone wrote a useless app that does nothing but try to be slowed down. So, let me back up one second. Right.
Okay.
So, having two page tables means that when an application asks the kernel to do something on its behalf, there has to be a context switching between the two page tables, which didn't used to have to happen because it was one page table for everyone. So that context switching from a non-kernel process asking the kernel to do something on its behalf, that switch where you hand over control and when control gets handed back. So it's the act of switching is now slower. So someone wrote an app which only switches. It does nothing else. It just switches over back to me, to you, to me, to you, to me, to you. Mm. And in that app, which does nothing apart from switch context, it is slowed down 30%.
Okay.
That is a preposterous, ridiculous app. It was designed to be the absolute, absolute, absolute worst possible case. It is completely unrealistic by intention. But that's not how the number is being reported. So that is your absolute, absolute worst case. So in reality, how much your app is slowed down depends on how much your app interacts with the kernel. And so a game does almost no kernel interaction. So that's why most games are unaffected by this, which is a relief because a lot of the people whose first reaction was, I'm never updating my computer ever, were gamers who really, really, really want to eke every little bit of performance out of their computer. But thankfully, right. They fall into the category of people whose apps are very, very unaffected. The more an app interacts with the kernel, the more affected it is. And so that means that servery stuff is probably the most likely to be affected. Apple have done benchmarks, and Apple have found that in their benchmarks, the performance hit is about 2.5%.
Wow. On average across a bunch of different kind of stuff?
The worst of their benchmarks was 2.5%, which is actually in the change to Safari. Their changes to iOS and macOS are running at about 1%. Hmm. So, even if they're wrong by a factor, you know, let's say they're wrong by a factor of two, we're talking order of magnitude single digits, as opposed to order of magnitude tens.
Okay.
So that's fine, right? That's a big difference. An order of magnitude is a big difference. So it appears, and this is being borne out by other vendors too, it appears that you're talking about single-digit percentages of performance hit at worst in the real world, okay. Which is okay. I'll live with that.
Sure. That's good.
So thank goodness the slowdowns we feared are not as bad as we thought.
Good.
And that comes to the end of my show notes, apart from the links section here. So I genuinely advise people to look at the homepage for these bugs. It is short. The scroll bars are very short. It links to all of the advisories from all of the vendors. And it's just really well written. And it's pretty. They actually have really nice typography and very cute logos. I really like this page.
Yeah, I'm very impressed. Well done. It's interesting too.
Yeah, it's well written. That's hard. Technical writing at its finest. In terms of the best overview I found is from Ars Technica. They broke it down in a way that made my brain not hurt. And so I put their link second because I found that to be the single most useful link of the whole experience. Apple released a statement on support at apple.com. And to be honest, of the vendors, I think Apple did the best job of being human friendly. I really like the way Apple wrote it. It's clear, it's concise. So again, I would say if you're an Apple user, you by all means read this because it won't take you long and B, it won't make your head explode.
The best kind, right?
That's the best kind. I'm also linking to the Android release notes. I do not find them. They're very nerd-ese. I don't find them particularly human-friendly. What is human-friendly, though, is that Google have a status page where they have a table where they have all of their products in a table and the current status of their vulnerability, where they are in fixing it. And because that's constantly changing, that's a page that Google users should probably bookmark. Because what I say today could be different tomorrow.
Sure.
So this status page will continue to be accurate. This is not a snapshot. This is a dashboard. So that's useful.
So can I say something snotty about Android and the way their update's working?
By all means.
I don't know if you heard my phone making a bunch of noise. I did.
I was wondering what was going on there.
That was my Android phone. I believe I may have successfully muted the sounds. I could not find the setting because I'm not real familiar with it. But they do the thing. Remember in the old days, at least on Windows, you'd do a patch and it would reboot and it would go, oh, here's another one. And you reboot and you go, oh, here's another one.
Oh, God, yes.
That's what this is doing. So it just gave me the one from 11.17. So they're by month.
November. Okay. So you probably have a 12.
And one can 17, hope
12.
One can hope I have a 118. So I'm about to try to find the next one. But I have to remember each time where it is. But I'll figure it out. But I just thought it was interesting.
Depending on your model of phone, you may or may not have that patch level available to you today. It may take
27-12. We got one more to do. And each one is a restart too, which is nice.
Lovely. Anyway, the other links then in the show notes are Firefox's update. And then the last link is also from Ars Technica, which is a summary of how each company responded. So the chip makers, the OS vendors, the cloud providers in specific are looked at one by one in that Ars Technica story. So that was useful to me as well when making these show notes. So that's that. So now we can get into normal security light.
Wow.
There's not much else, right?
Well, technically, at least, Meltdown is a security light, is what happened, what's important, and what can we do about it? Patch, 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 patch.
Fair point, actually. And to be honest, that's also true of Spectre for us end users. So for us end users with Spectre, we just, as they play whack-a-mole over the next couple of years, we just have to keep applying the patches they whack. So as an end user, the answer, you're right. The answer to an end user is patch, 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 patch. Yeah, okay, I'll take it. That's a really good TLDR summary. Just patch everything.
Well, I can tell that message is getting out. My friend Melanie, who is not terribly technical at all, but she pays me in wine to help her with her devices, which is fun.
In wine?
I know.
That is a good currency. I approve.
Yeah. And good wine. Two of my girlfriends do that. Anyway, she just wrote to me yesterday and said, so I guess I'm supposed to patch everything. What do I do? Yes. That's
excellent.
Good.
Excellent. Yeah. I knew this was a big deal when my alarm went off and I turned on the radio and I listened to RTE Radio 2, which is, their 8 a.m. news bulletin is 3 minutes long. And they covered this story.
Wow.
It's like, that 3-minute bulletin almost never mentions the word computer. They did for Heartbleed and they did for this. Wow. And that immediately put it into my mind. It's like, okay, this is reels. Time for me to get up and open my RSS reader and I guarantee it will not be empty. And lo and behold, it was not empty. I had a lot of reading to do. Anyway, So into our regular old boring stuff. Notable security updates, apart from all of these ones we've just mentioned, which is, you know, so we've mentioned loads of them there. There is a critical update for Thunderbird, which would have been important in the grand scheme of things because it allows all sorts of nasty remote code execution and stuff. But really, in the given everything else that's happened this week, it doesn't seem quite so scary. But anyway, if you're using Thunderbird, let it update itself. Firefox have also had to do an unscheduled update. Oh, sorry, Mozilla have had to do an unscheduled update to Firefox for a very embarrassing bug. It's not set your hair on fire, but it's kind of like a doh. So you're probably familiar with the fact that they have a crash reporter. When Firefox crashes, a separate app starts called Firefox Crash Reporter that lets you fill in the details and send off your crash report to Mozilla. Yeah, I'm sure you've seen it.
Yeah.
It's only supposed to send it when you explicitly give it your permission. Turns out there was a bug and it was sending it even when you didn't give your permission. And those crash reports contain a whole bunch of sensitive information extracted from your computer, or at least hypothetically sensitive if you work in certain environments. So it will be things like the URLs you're currently browsing to, the titles of your tabs, those kind of things, which for 99% of us are not sensitive. But if you work in certain industries, just knowing where you are could be a problem, right, in the web sense. So Mozilla have A, apologized, B, fixed the bug, and C, deleted all the crash logs.
Oh, good, good.
Because they don't know which ones they have permission for, so they've made the assumption they have no permission for any of them. Which is a good response, but it's somewhat embarrassing that our crash reporter has a bug. But anyway, it's been fixed. Notable news, apart from the obvious. So I think this is worth drawing attention to because I think this is a glimpse into the future. So Apple released their iMac Pro, which is a beautiful machine in many ways. But something that's being lost amidst the drooling over the 12 cores of CPU and the amazing 5K display and the beautiful metal black finish that I want for my keyboard and trackpad is that they have also changed the security model of the iMac Pro to be much closer actually to how an iOS device works. This thing has a really good secure boot feature so that it is way harder to get malicious stuff to boot up on these devices. So there's two good reports on what that means and how Apple are doing it, one from the Mac Observer and one from iMore. And so I popped them into the show notes because I think the improved security on this device, this is only in this one machine for now, but I would be shocked if this didn't start to make its way back into Apple's laptops and desktops over the next few years. And it's a good security feature for all of us to have. I thought that was worth highlighting.
How fun. Until we can now, get Touch ID or Face ID everywhere, right?
Well, that too. I mean, we also want that. That will also be a nice... A Face ID in particular, I just see as being so iMac friendly.
Yeah, just look at it.
Just exactly. So I'm always looking at my screen, right? So the whole gaze detection, the whole thing can just port over. So I hope that happens. I really hope that happens. This next story is one that may have been a security medium in a normal week. So Microsoft's Hello is a very similar feature to Face ID. Unfortunately, it has been shown that it can be spoofed not by a difficult-to-make mask, but by a photo. What? And this is unfortunately because while Windows Hello can use Fancy Pants IR features in Fancy Pants cameras, it also can't. It can also not do that and still authenticate you to the device. And so the Fancy Pants feature they call Enhanced Anti-Spoofing. And that only works on computers with cameras that support advanced anti-spoofing.
But I thought they only allowed Windows Hello on the Fancy Pants cameras. That was why it was kind of slow for adoption at first.
Well, they've obviously backed off from that, or else there's enhanced and very enhanced. But basically, it's been found that most devices where Windows Hello is being used, like Dells and stuff, do not in fact support enhanced anti-spoofing. And what they found that is even worse is that just because your device can do enhanced anti-spoofing doesn't mean it is, because by default, it's often off. And my editorial note here is, how is that possible? As far as I'm concerned, Windows Hello should look at your camera and say, can you do the enhanced stuff? You are forced to do the enhanced stuff. It should not even... There shouldn't be a switch,
right?
But there is, and the default position of that switch is off, according to these security researchers, and they have specific laptop makes and models to back up their case. So I think this is legitimate security research. So basically what we have found is that Windows Hello can be very secure, but in reality, in the real world, often really isn't.
I don't understand why something this is Microsoft just being,
need to fix.
How could this just be figured out? That seems like something awfully obvious, that somebody would try to spoof Windows Hello with a photograph. Something must have changed.
They're being very slightly clever. Okay, no, not very slightly. They're being clever, but not in a difficult to replicate way. So the cameras look at IR instead of at visible light. So if you just print a photo of yourself without making any tweaks to the photo, it won't work. But all you have to do is apply a filter to the photo to make certain colors darker and certain colors brighter, and then it will look correct in IR, and then a normal photo from a normal printer will let you in if you apply this filter. So the smart bit is that they found this filter. So you take a normal photograph, run it through this filter, like an Instagram filter, but carefully chosen, obviously, right, and then it will let you in. So that's the clever bit. That's why it wasn't done before.
It's been out for years. This seems obvious.
It does, but the thing that gets me is the fact that any device that can do enhanced, why would it ever not do enhanced? Like, why would you never be as secure as the device can be? I don't get. But that's fixable by a software update, right? So my hope is that Microsoft look at this research and go, oopsie daisies, let's change this default, and this default. And then I think Microsoft Hello will be a lot more safe.
You know, when I'm always looking for a way to say that, Mac OS is better than Windows, and to torture my Windows friends about it, right? I mean, that's our sport.
Mm-hmm.
And I went on a rampage searching for any comparison of Windows Hello to Face ID, mostly because Rod Simmons of the SMR podcast was saying, well, I don't trust Face ID. I'm not going to use it because I heard a twin can trick it. I was like, oh my gosh. So I went out looking specifically for this, and I could find no comparison of the two, and I could find nothing about this being anything but spectacular. So if this default has been off all this time, why? I couldn't find it in it.
Okay.
I would have found that, and I would have rubbed his nose in it. You know me.
There's a few things going on here. So first off, if you can put the word Apple in a headline, you're going to get clicks. If you put the word Microsoft in a headline, yeah, it's just not as, if you'll excuse the phrase, sexy.
Yeah.
And Face ID is now in use on millions of devices. Microsoft Hello is not the phenomenon that Face ID is, because Microsoft isn't as sexy.
Yeah. I'm just really surprised. It just seems like maybe they flipped a switch that made it not default on, like it used to be on, and then for some reason they changed it.
I think it's a case that it never got as much scrutiny as Apple got, because it's never been as sexy as Apple stuff.
Hmm. Yeah.
Because, you know,
yeah.
What we see reported in the news is not an accurate reflection of reality. It's a reflection of what all the news sites think will get them clicks.
Hmm.
And it doesn't always serve our best interest. And I think we've just been let down here. I think this wasn't scrutinized as much as it should have been.
Yeah.
That's my take on it. It's an interpretation of the visible facts. I'm not saying that's an opinion, not a statement of fact, but that's my feeling about it.
Okay.
Next one is then New York Times had a report of a whole bunch of games that have been found to be using the microphone on your smartphone to figure out what you're watching on television and send it back to a tracking agency. Now, there's some silver linings here. Okay, the first thing I should say is that this affects mostly Google Play Store games, but there are a few in the App Store, as in the iOS App Store, that do this too. But the silver lining is that both Android and iOS will pop up a dialogue saying, hi, this app would like access to your microphone. So unless you have said yes, the app can't do this. But I think an awful lot of people click yes without thinking about it. You know, so if a game of Connect 4 or whatever says, I'd like your microphone, the answer is no.
Right.
You know, but I think, so basically it's happening, it's real. This isn't a report of a theoretical problem. These games exist today. They do use the mic if you let them, and they do spy on you and report back what you're watching on television. That's the news story. And then finally, a little PSA for users of Spotify. A tool has been found in the wild which does brute force attacks against Spotify usernames and passwords. Unfortunately, Spotify's services are not well secured against brute force attacks. Excuse me one sec. Sorry about that. In theory, an online service should do rate limiting, and it should do CAPTCHAs, and it should do two-factor auth to protect your username and password from just being hammered at. And Spotify just don't. So you can write a script that just tries password after password after password after password. So if you have a strong password, it'll still take the age of the universe, so you're grand. But if you're a Spotify user with a weak password, you're in real danger. So the PSA is, of all of the passwords out there, Spotify is one you need to make sure is long. Long really is the most important thing. Long is just the enemy of brute forcing. Make your Spotify password a nice, long, secure one, because it is under more threat than your average password, because Spotify are doing a poor job protecting passwords, and someone has written a tool which is freely available in the dark web that automates this process. So someone with no technical knowledge can just set the tool off and start collecting usernames and passwords.
And anyone who's thinking, well, I don't really care if my Spotify account gets hacked. Yes, you do, because you got a credit card in there. Maybe,
yep.
maybe you got a free account, so maybe you don't. But if you have a short, stupid password, I'm just guessing you've got it used someplace else.
Yes. Absolutely. Password reuse is a real problem here. And the accounts most likely to get hacked are also the accounts most likely to be reused.
Right.
Ah, okay, so that's the end of notable news. A few little things in suggested reading. Under the PSA's tips and advice, two nice iMore stories. How to create an Apple ID for a family member. I think a lot of people are struggling with this right now, being as it is the start of January and lots of people have shiny new devices. And how to back up your iPhone, iPad and Mac, the ultimate guide.
Oh,
given how many people have new devices, this is a good time to have a read of that article.
Yeah, yeah.
A few things in the news, just relating to Facebook. If people are interested, they can read that in suggested reading. And in Propeller Beanies, there is an interesting article, but it's very nerdy. And it might have made an interesting security medium on a really, really, really quiet news day. But if anyone wants to go a bit nerdy on how sensors can be used to guess pins 83% of the time, and how easy this is going to be for the OS vendors to fix, and
four
they probably
pins.
Will. It's in Propeller Beanie.
Okay.
And the last thing we have then is our palate cleanser, relates right back to the big story of the week. XKCD meets Meltdown Inspector. They have done an XKCD comic about this topic because, well, it's quite clearly topical. I don't know if you want to read it out or if you want to just leave it as a link.
I think it's better as a link. I don't think it tells well as a joke, but it's the graphics aren't that important, but it'd be difficult to do the meter of it correctly to make it as funny as it is.
And the other thing to say to people is, as with every XKCD comic, hover your mouse over the cartoon because the hover text, the alt text, is always part of it's like a joke on top of the joke for the people who are in the community.
I think that's the title text that shows, not the alt text, by the way.
You are absolutely correct, Allison.
Look at me, little HTML nerdlet, aren't I?
Yes, you are, because the alt text is only for screen readers. The title text is for the hover.
Right.
So there we go. That is one very full security section.
Are you exhausted or what?
Yeah, it's 1 o'clock in the morning. Wow.
Well, as I said at the beginning, I'm really glad that we did not start quite a while ago. A couple of days ago, I think it would have been much worse. This just in, my Android phone does not have the patch, and I've asked Rod Simmons to check for me on whether or not his settings were by default to have that off on his laptop, because I'd really like to know. But he says he's going to run and go check right this minute.
Yeah, because given that he uses the hello feature, he's going to want to know that. Yeah, so the Android patch was released today, so that's going to take some time to go through the vendors and to go through that whole Android dance. So I'll be very curious to see how long it takes to get to you.
Yeah, it would be an interesting experiment. Since it's a Google phone, it's not going through anybody. It's only going from Google.
Yeah, it still might take 24 hours to make it to the download servers
but
and stuff.
It better not be March.
Agreed. Yes, yes, that would indeed be very bad, because if you're getting it from March on a Google phone, just imagine what it's like for someone running some sort of cheapy Android phone.
I just realized 10.13.2, that means I need to get my in-laws onto High Sierra sooner than I was going to. And that means discussing Microsoft Office with them, which means upgrading them to a new version, which means we need to drive to Fresno.
And it means a lot of change. Well, actually, how Money much has the UI changed between the version they're on and the new version?
Enough.
Okay.
Steve's mom will pick it up right away. Steve's dad will find it more challenging. And, you know, he gets there and he's super serious about security. So he will do it. He will take on the challenge, but it's not something I want to just fling on him over Skype. Here, push this button.
Yeah, here we go. I've just changed your entire spreadsheet app, which is one of your most dearest and most beloved apps. It's all completely different now. Bye.
I was really happy, though, when the last time he had to do this, I said, well, it's going to change the way it looks a lot. And he says, that's okay. It's insecure. Aha. Do it. So he's the best about that. He's really good about that. So
one of my favorite things you have done is that video you recorded with Ken about password managers.
Oh, like yeah.
That is such a useful thing for the community. So I have no doubt he is more than capable of dealing with the change to Microsoft Office. And like you say, now that he's going to have a good motivation, you know, I'm sorry, we can't wait anymore. This is a security issue now.
Yeah, I just don't know when I can get to him. We'll get there.
We'll get there. And I guess there are... Okay, so we're going off topic now, but... I'm curious whether you think it's an Office 365 subscription or whether it's a standalone new version of Office you're thinking of.
Well, I said about when I talked to him about a couple of, maybe it's just last week's show, he bought had some bananas in his fruit bowl and a friend of his came over. He's, I don't know, 80, 82, something like that. And his friend came over and he saw the bananas in the bowl and noticed they were green. And he said, wow, you're an optimist. So the question is, you know, do you feel lucky on the cost? You buy two standalone copies, which unfortunately is what they decided to do last time. And so now that I've got to tell them to do it again, they figured, okay, they would last, you know, in 3 years it would pay off. But now it'd be, you know, it's $300 to get two licenses, I think.
There is a family option for Office 365 subscriptions, isn't there?
Right, but it's $100 a year.
So it's three years to pay it back. That's not that lucky? Long.
Yeah.
And I guess the question is, would they get value out of the web versions of the apps?
Nope.
Nope.
Would they get value out of an iPad app? No, probably not. Probably standalone.
Yeah, okay. So yeah, because I get a lot of value out of everything apart from the apps. You know, to me, the cloudy bit is the value, but... that's really not the case for everyone. So that's why I was asking.
I should go play with the cloudy bit. I haven't really done that. I haven't really played with it since I got it.
You know, I'm using it from a school's point of view because Microsoft have a school's version of Office 365, which is what obviously I use for work.
Yeah.
And so it's all about groupware, right? It's all about working together as a team and stuff like that. Microsoft Teams is, it's brilliant. And it's going to replace Skype for Business. Microsoft have announced that Skype for Business is on the death list. It's going away. Alla bloody Luia.
Well, we're going to have to start talking about a replacement for Skype, apparently. All the cool kids are moving to Discord.
We'll give that a go. I can tell you what it won't be.
What?
There's an app called Wire, which the guys from the Essential Apple podcast insist on using. It is the most buggy, crashy, infuriating piece of poop I've ever come across, to the point that it made me love Skype.
Oh, jeez. I haven't had any trouble with Skype other than not being able to find menus. But I've worked with, I forget who I worked with who was blind. And it was just like, I was trying to tell them where stuff was and I was watching their screen and it's just not saying anything. They have really borked up the accessibility. Yeah, it's really unfortunate. Should get...
Anyway.
It's interesting.
We've possibly milked this. I know you were saying you were off to CES next week, so you were happy to have a long show, but perhaps we have sufficiently done that.
Yeah, I think so. I don't know if I'm going to have any content for the show at all for me. We'll see.
Well, we've just talked about Office 365, right? So it's not all security.
There we go. Well, I don't think your exit line has ever been more appropriate than it will be right now.
Yes. Patch everything. and stay secure.
Well, I hope you guys appreciated that extended edition delivered early. I didn't tell you guys that are listening that we actually did an experiment tonight. I am broadcasting on Facebook Live at the same time I'm broadcasting to podfee.com/live, which has, you know, created surprisingly little anarchy. I'm not really sure why that didn't cause things to explode. We were looking to make a little more sausage than usual because that's the way the chat room likes it. I don't know that I'll keep doing this because it does kind of fragment the audience, but I think I'll pin a comment in Facebook that if you want the full experience, you actually get more out of podfee.com/live because it's got the chat room and the video has Steve in it. I mean, if you only want me, you can go watch over on Facebook.com/live, but you can only hear this disembodied voice of Steve when you're over on Facebook. But anyway, it was just kind of fun to do an experiment and see what could happen. I thought we would have a small chat room today because it is an off day, but actually things have been hopping in there. But I got to tell you, it's going to wind us up for this week. Do not forget to send in your dumb questions, comments, and suggestions by emailing me at allison@podfeet.com. And by the way, a bunch of people have sent in content that I couldn't squeeze into this week, which is spectacular because now I have no stress going into CES week because I know I don't have to write a lot of content because we have a lot of great listener contributions, and I'm really excited about that. Anyway, that don't stop writing to me. You should still write to me at allison@podfeet.com. You can follow me on Twitter at podfeet. And remember, everything great is at podfeet.com. You want to help support the show? Podfeet.com/Patreon. Want to give a single donation? Podfeet.com/PayPal. Want to go to our Facebook group and have a lot of fun over there? Podfeet.com/Facebook. Like the Google Plus thing better than the Facebook thing? We support that as well. Podfeet.com/Google Plus. And if you want to just buy stuff from Amazon and help the show, go to podfeet.com/Amazon. And if you want to join in the fun of the live show, like Joe Prizer did for the very first time this week, head on over to podfeet.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time and join the friendly and enthusiastic Nocilla Castaways. We will be back on schedule starting next week. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.